Okay, if you're here for the first time or if you have not received one of these little booklets, if you'll raise your hand, I'll get somebody to bring one around to you. Tyrone, can you get these out for me, please, sir?
Thank you.
You bet. Hold your hand up and Tyrone will get you a copy there. Okay, we are in still in the first section of Romans, chapter 1, verse 18 through chapter 3, verse 20, is discussing how and why a person is lost, or if you a word would be condemnation. I got some more here, Tyrone. And we have a question that we have given for you to keep coming back to, because I know that the conclusion of 118 to 320 that we're about to arrive at this morning is not an easy conclusion, because whenever traditionally when someone has talked about people who've never had a chance to hear the gospel, are they lost or are they saved, our answer is God is a God of love. That's our answer. But that doesn't answer the problem. God is a God of love. But that's not everything that there is to say about God. There is another part of God, another characteristic of God, that I'm going to suggest to you even. I won't say it that way. I started to say it overrides his love. It doesn't, because it doesn't have to. But God will be righteous if God is not love. The primary characteristic of God is righteous. And whenever we start out, if you sit down in a group of people who are religious people and you say, God is blank, 9 people out of 10 will say, God is love. And that's right, and that's true. And John said it that way, exactly that way, at least twice. God is love. And you can't say enough about God's love and goodness and patience and kindness and long-suffering. You can't say enough about it. You can't overstate it, unless that's all you ever see of God. And then you have a caricature of God, not a true picture. You know the difference between a caricature and a true picture, right? A caricature is when you take one particular characteristic of a person and you exaggerate that. Have any of you ever had a caricature drawn of you? They're not particularly flattering, are they? They might be funny a little bit. They're funnier to your wife or your husband than they are to you, but they take a part that you might already be a little bit sensitive about, and they exaggerate it, and they make it, if you have a large nose, and they make a really big old honker out here, and if you have, in my case, you have big ears, and they just draw these, look like the door of a taxi, 2 doors open going down the road, so it's not real flattering. And some of us, rather than having a good, accurate picture of God, we have a caricature. We've taken certain characteristics that we like, and we've emphasized that to the exclusion of others. And so, as we come to know God, and there, as you say, God is love, there are qualities of God that demonstrate that love. There's kindness and long-suffering and patience and goodness. And you can just, we preach sermons and we've taught classes on all those things. Those things illustrate God's love. But there's also another major characteristic, and God is righteous. And there are certain things that illustrate God's righteousness also. God is going, his judgment is going to be righteous and just. And that will lead the New Testament writer to say, behold the goodness and the, what, of God? Severity. God is really, really, really good. And God can be really, really, really severe. Case in point, the flood. Was that pretty severe? Was God love when he did that? yeah, he was still love, but he was righteous. And God's love will never set aside his righteousness. Someone has said, and I think rightly so, and it was R.C. Bell in his little book on something Romans. Somebody asked me about that the other day, that little book. But anyway, forgot the name of this little black book about that thick. It's out of print now. But he said, God's wrath is his love in agony. That's worth you thinking about some. God, even when he punishes, does so, and he does not set aside his love. We used to, I hope you don't anymore, whenever you start to give your kid, woman up his backside, and you say, this is going to hurt me more than it hurts you, don't tell your kid that. They don't have any framework to understand that. You know, and you can say, you'll understand this one day, but that don't help them right now, does it? But it's true, isn't it? I mean, do you punish your child because you enjoy doing that? I hope you don't. I hope you don't. And I know you don't. But it doesn't set your love aside because you do punish them. So God's wrath is his love in agony. Was it a loving thing that God did when he destroyed the earth with water? Well, it was certainly a loving thing to the next generation that came along, wasn't it? There wasn't anything in that world, if every thought of man's heart was only continually evil, there wasn't anything in that world that was going to cause a person to turn to God. And so it was an act of kindness. The only hope that we've ever had, you do by now realize, the only hope that we as people of this world, the only hope we ever have is that God will punish us when we need punishing. If he just lets us keep going, we don't get better. We get worse. And whenever God punishes us, what does it do? It makes us turn to him. It takes away the things that we trust in, the things that give us this false sense of security, and we start casting around to find out if there is something, in fact, that is secure. And we find God, who's the same yesterday, today, and forever. And so as we talk about how and why a person's lost in Romans chapter 1, verse 18 through 3:20, then there's a question that I keep calling you back to. Because I know that your mind has to struggle with the conclusions that he draws here. And there are some things that if somebody doesn't force us to and hold our feet to the fire, that we'll never admit in life. You know, there are some things about myself that I know that I choose to ignore. Sometimes my wife holds my feet to the fire. And she makes me see some things and admit some things about myself that I kind of know, but I kind of push under the rug and I don't really want to think about it and talk about it and admit it. And sometimes I'm forced to admit that. And when I am forced to admit that, then puts a responsibility on me to change my life or change my attitude or whatever it may be that needs to be changed. Well, it's the same way as we deal with God's Word. There are some things that we kind of know, but we really don't want to say it because if you don't say it, it's not real kind of thing, you know? But if somebody makes us say it, then we have to start dealing with it. And so when we talk about, is this person who's never had a chance to hear the gospel, are they lost or are they saved? If we don't ever say it, we don't have to deal with it. If we just say God's a God of love and he'll take care of that, then we don't ever have to really get down and deal with it. And I think that that's part of our lack of zeal for evangelism, because we've not said it for so long that we've kind of convinced ourselves maybe they're all right. And God, after all, God is love, and that's just the salve that takes care of everything. That answers everything. What if Jesus Christ had never come to this earth? Would man be lost or would he be saved? That's our question. And we keep coming back to that question. If you say that man would be okay, you just indicted the gospel and the cross and God. If he's okay without the gospel, then I'm going to make a personal plea to you, don't take it to him. Because he might reject it. And if he does, then what kind of shape's he in? I mean, even in our reasoning at that point, right? Even as we try to push it all aside, if he hears it and rejects it, then he's lost. But somehow we've got this attitude, if he never had a chance to hear the gospel, then he's not lost. Really now. So, we would all be better off if there was no gospel. If not, why not? And so what I'm saying to you, no, I'm not saying it to you. What the Bible is saying to you is, Jesus Christ came to seek and save that which was lost. It already was lost. And because it already was lost, that means that everything associated with the gospel, and that would be the Bible and the church and baptism and church attendance, all of those things have nothing to do with why a person's lost. He's lost without the gospel. And so the gospel and the things associated with the gospel are not the reason that a person is lost. So a person is not lost because he hasn't been baptized. He's lost because he sinned. And until we get that down firmly in our brains, we're not going to progress much further. He's lost because he sinned. What is sin? Transgression of God's law. Then that means that everybody had to have access to God's law. Is that right? That is right. And they do. For the Gentiles who have not the law do by nature the things contained in the law. These, having not the law, become a law unto themselves. Moral law within a man. And so we looked at this in Romans chapter 2. We pulled out three principles that God will use to judge the man apart from the gospel. The man under law. We all have God-given law. Have you ever told somebody that it's wrong to do something? By the way, when you tell somebody it's wrong to do something, what did you just attest to? That you have a standard of right and wrong. You didn't say... You know, you did by saying that, but you didn't say all the way across the board, where is that standard? But you said, I have a standard. You, when you go to somebody, you tell your child, it's wrong for you to do that. You're saying, I have a standard of right and wrong. That's law. Where did you get it? Is it just an accident that people everywhere in every society for all times have rules about certain things? Like murder and adultery. They're not the same all over the world, but everywhere, every society has rules and laws about those things. Where'd they get them? Did they just fall out of the air somewhere? They got them from God. Where did all this start? In the Garden of Eden, when they ate of the tree that was called what tree? The knowledge of good and evil. And when they ate of that tree, what happened to them? They had the knowledge of good and evil. And every person since that time has had a standard of awareness. Now, you leave us alone in the society, and we'll take that standard from here to here to here to here to here, and we'll keep lowering that standard, won't we? But we still have it somewhere. I mean, it stops somewhere there. You know, when you don't tread on me, don't mess with my rights. And so we have to start determining what those rights are and what you're not supposed to do and what I'm not supposed to do and so forth. And so all men have God-given law. Now, we got over here to chapter 3 last time, and there was a series of questions that the Jew will ask. Whenever we got the first part of chapter 1 and halfway through chapter 2, then the Jew is saying, and he's thinking as he listens to what Paul has to say, boy, you're right on target, Paul. These Gentiles, they're the sorriest people that, you know, I don't even know why God created them. They're just so immoral and ungodly and sorry, and they deserve all the punishment that you could just pour on them. And then Paul will say, and you who call yourself a Jew, and you rest in the law, and you're confident that you're blind, you're a guide to those that are blind, and that you're a light to those in darkness, don't you listen to what you say? You preach, don't do this, but do you do it? And they would say what? No, we don't do it. And Paul would say, yes, you do. Yes, you do. Just because you call it by a different name doesn't mean that you don't do it. And so he convicts them, and he'll end up by saying, the Gentile he doesn't want anything. The name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. They don't even claim to be following God. They live the way they do, and you claim to be following God, and look at the way you live. And so they look at you, and they say, hey, if that's the way a Christian looks, I don't want anything to do with Christianity. And so the Jew's not real happy. He's never had anybody talk to him like this, and he particularly has never had another Jew to talk to him like this. And so he has some questions. And by the way, he ends up by saying, the things that you trust in, your circumcision is valuable if you keep the law. If you do what that circumcision indicated, but guess what you don't do? You don't keep the law. And so he says, you know who the true Jew is? It's not the one who's circumcised outwardly. It's the one whose heart is circumcised. That God's cut away the sin and they really follow God with their heart. And the things that would keep us away from God, we get rid of in our life, and we really concentrate and focus on God. And he said, and they will judge you one day. Wow. Boy, if we put that in a modern context, we'd get upset too. You know that? If we put that in the context, if he was talking to us as Christians, and he said, you know, all these people out here that are so terrible, and you read about in the newspaper, and you just categorize them and lump them all here, what if he said those things to us? What if I said, got up and said that this morning? I can tell you the hair on the back of your neck would start standing up, and you'd start saying, hey, I don't think I like this preacher very much. And they didn't like Paul very much, did they? In fact, they were constantly pursuing him, trying to kill him, trying to shut his mouth. And so then he will, in his writing, he knows where their mind is going to go, and so he asks the questions. First one is in chapter 3, verse 1. Is there not any advantage to being a Jew then, if what you're saying is true? And he says, yeah, there's lots of advantage. You've had every advantage. Primarily unto you, God committed his word unto you, the oracles of God. He gave them to you. And then they'll say in verse 3, but what if some didn't have faith? Will their lack of faith nullify God's faithfulness? And okay, God made a covenant with them. They broke their side of the covenant. Does that mean that God's not going to be faithful to what he said? He said, let me tell you something about God. If everybody in the world stands up and raises their right hand and swears a lie, that's not going to sway God. If every man in the world is a liar, God will tell the truth and God will live up to his part of this deal. Well, that's good to know about God, by the way, because I've messed up my end of our deal. Hadn't you? I haven't lived up to my part of the things that I've told God I would do. And so I'm glad that that didn't just mean, okay, then he's not going to do that. He's not going to live up to what he said either. Then, you know what? I'm really messed up. I'm left spinning in the wind with nowhere to go. And so then the third question, and this is really one of those questions we spent probably an inordinate amount of time on it last time because it's kind of a strange argument. Because he said, if our unrighteousness makes God look righteous, then why is God condemning me for being unrighteous? And he will say, I'm speaking like a man, right? I'm making a human argument here. And it's a convoluted argument. It's the dog that has hold of his tail and he's going in a circle here. And he's saying, you know, God, whenever he forgives me of my sin, then I'm making God look good. God's righteousness is shining, and he's looking good, Because I'm a sinner. And so why is he condemning me for being a sinner? And he handles that with that. He said, he didn't say it in these words, but I'll say it for him. He said, that's stupid. How is God going to judge the world? God's going to judge the world in righteousness. And so the fact that you are a sinner and God is righteous, and the result of that is that when he forgives you, he looks good, that doesn't mean that somebody's not going to answer for your sin. And now he's got one more question we'll pick up here for this week. Verse 9. What shall we conclude then? And let me rephrase it just a little bit. He says, are we any better? And we could say, to get the thrust of what he's saying, aren't we any better than them? And he says, you got it. No. You are not any better than them. Now, can you imagine? And I'm saying to you, you probably can't imagine, nor can I, how hard that hit the Jew. I'm not any better than these wicked Gentiles out here. Is that what you're telling me? You got it. He can save them just as easily as he can save you. It takes the same thing to save them that it took to save you. And that don't go down too well with us good folks, do it? We kind of choke on that right here when we see this person out here who is a murderer. And you go visit the prison and you see all these drug dealers and you see all these people out here and you say, God, are you telling me I'm not any better than they are? You got it, Stegall. Finally sinking in. You're both in the same boat. Where's that boat? It's a long ways from God. Because I'm unrighteous, just like he or she is unrighteous. Aren't we any better? Not at all. We already made the charge that Jews and Gentiles alike are all under sin, and now he's going to go back and he's going to quote a few of the Psalms, and he's going to put them together, and he's going to, let's read it real quickly, as it is written, and this is his evidence that you're not any better than the Gentile is. There is no one righteous, not even one. Now, he could stop right there. If that's true, that covers the bases right there, doesn't it? God looked the world over from the beginning of time to the end of time. He's not limited by time. And he looked at every person's life, including mine, including yours. And what's the verdict? There is none righteous, not even one. There is no one who understands, no one who searches for God. All have turned away and together become worthless. There is no one who does good, not even one. He's talking about you. And he's talking about me. Their throats are open graves. Their tongues practice deceit. The poison of vipers is on their lips. You notice how he's picking the body parts here? Throats, tongues, lips. Their mouths are full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Ruin and misery mark their paths. The way of peace they do not know. There is no fear of God before their eyes. You can go through and pick out the body parts there. Now we know whatever the law says, it says to those who are under law. Who's under law? The Jews are under the law of Moses. Gentiles are under moral law. Who's under law? We're all under law. Whatever the law says, it says to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be silenced. King James Version said every mouth may be stopped and the whole world become guilty before God. This says every mouth may be silenced and the whole world held accountable to God. What does it mean when it says every mouth will be stopped? What does it mean? You don't have any rebuttal. Why? Because God took the law that you live by, the law that you live by, and he judged you by it. And guess what the outcome is? There are no buts. You know what it means when you say, but. There's none of that. He took them all away. How did he do that? He took the law that you live by. He didn't open some book you've never seen before in your life and judge you by it. He took the law that you live by, and he judged you by that law, And he convicted you of sin about which you are aware. It won't be a surprise to you. He's not going to convict you of not coming to church if you never heard of church. And not being baptized if you never heard about baptized. He's going to take the law that you live by. He's going to judge you by it. This is how it's going to be judged under law. He's going to judge you by it, and the result is there is none righteous, not even one. That's me, and that's you. And that's that guy that lived in the 12th century in some remote, for us remote, part of the world. By the way, we were remote from them too. Every single one of us. There's none righteous, not even one. The ground at the foot of the cross is level. You don't stand any closer to God than anybody else does. We're all in the same boat, and it ain't bound for heaven. Now, we know that whatever the law says, it says to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be silenced and the whole world held accountable to God. The basis on which God is going to judge the world. If you're not in Christ. The only thing we know from 118 to 320 is law. That's all we know. And so if you're going to stand before God and be judged by law, then he says the whole world is going to be held accountable to God. And what's the result? Verse 20. And you can underline or highlight or circle or whatever you want to, but you need to put verse 20 somehow, make it stand out in your Bible. Therefore, this is the conclusion of everything we've said. If we really understood this verse, I could have skipped everything we've said up to this point and just gone this one verse right here. But we need some help to make sure that we understand this, don't we? Therefore, no one will be declared righteous in his sight by observing, and the word "the" is not in the text, by observing law. Can you be saved by law? Law can't save you. Can you be saved under law? Yeah, you can, but not by law. You can be saved by grace through faith. But you can't be saved by law unless you can keep it perfectly. Never make not one single mistake one time. And then the law didn't save you. You saved yourself. The law just didn't condemn you. You with me? Anybody got a question? I won't say speak now or forever hold your peace, but if you're too bashful to say it out loud, well, come to me, because you really need to understand this. We need to talk about this until you understand this, because there's no use in going any further, because you're never going to understand or appreciate grace until you understand this right here. Yes, somebody. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, and anybody, did y'all hear what she was saying? She said she has someone in her family that is from a broken home, and as she's with one parent, they have a set of rules, and she's has to live by those, and then she lives with the other parent, and they have no rules, and consequently now she's older, an older teenager, and she doesn't understand the difference between right and wrong. What would you say to that? By the way, she does understand the difference between right and wrong. It may be down here, but she does understand it. And if she doesn't, it will be taught to her in her life. If she kills somebody, what's going to happen to her? She's going to understand, right? If she cheats in the wrong situation, then there's going to be consequences, and she's going to understand it. There is no place that we live without law. Now, it almost can seem that way, that people can, you know, be so violent, or they can ignore what they know for so long that it seems like that they don't understand right and wrong, but they do. They do. I mean, even a violent criminal understands that there's a right and wrong, even if he says he doesn't. When you really sit down and talk to him, there is a standard at which he understands. Now, can you ignore your conscience so long that it doesn't bother you to do wrong? Yes, you can. You can kill your conscience, can't you? But that doesn't mean that God's not going to hold you accountable to that standard of right and wrong, which you are aware. You can ignore it, and you can push. You know, young people are going to push, lean on the fences as far as you let them, and they're going to push them as far as you let them push them, aren't they? Huh? And we are too, by the way. We just don't do it as overtly. We do it in more covert ways. But there is nobody without law. Everybody has an awareness of right and wrong. We can live in such a way that we suppress it. But that doesn't mean that we're not going to be held accountable for it. So, therefore, no one will be declared righteous in his sight by observing law. Therefore, no one will be righteous in his sight by observing law. Therefore, no one will be declared righteous in his sight by observing law. Therefore, how many times do we need to say it? We keep coming back and arguing with it sometimes. But it's there. And it's an absolute. Was there anybody that's ever lived that's been saved by law? No. Was there one person who wasn't condemned by law? There was one. God became man, and he fulfilled the law. Every single part of it, didn't he? And so the law didn't condemn him. He's the only one, and he owned it. It didn't own him. He owned it. Rather, through law, we become conscious of sin. Does the law, is it for a good purpose? Sure it is. That's one of the purposes that it serves. It teaches us right and wrong. It sets up a standard of right and wrong by which, if we never know anything other than law, by which we will be judged. And the result will be, there is none righteous, not even one. Through law, no one will be declared righteous in his sight. Now, that's 118 to 320. And we're ready, and this is, I told you, you're going to be ready to get out of this. So now we're ready to get out of this that we've been slogging through here. And now we're ready to start getting up and breathing some clean air. It's gotten pretty raunchy, hasn't it? If nobody's going to be saved. But now a righteousness, and you notice he starts out, but now. So he's going to show you a contrast. He's going to flip the coin over. But now, a righteousness, number one, from God. As opposed to what? As opposed to from law. Now, a righteousness from God, apart from law, has been made known, to which the law and the prophets testify. Hold your finger right there. And go back to chapter 1, verse 17. For in the gospel, a righteousness from God is revealed, a righteousness that is by faith from first to last, or is from faith to faith, just as it is written, by faith the righteous will live. You caught what I just did? As it is written, by faith the righteous will live. By law the unrighteous will die. By faith the righteous will live. Where are they going to get this faith? They're not going to get it from law. Where are they going to get it? From God. And if we're going to be righteous, then that righteousness is going to be a gift. And we've said sporadically through this study, if you stand before God and you have one single sin charged against you, you're not going to heaven. There won't be any sin in heaven. There'll only be righteousness. You don't want to stand before God and be judged by law if you've ever violated law one time, because law can't do anything to help you. There won't be any sin in heaven. Not one. Well, man, that leaves me out. It deals me out, doesn't it, you? Because I'm a sinner. So I need to look somewhere else for my righteousness other than how good I am and what I do. And God, the good news is that there is, we've got to shift into another dimension here, not just change gears, because all of our life we've been thinking about what we're doing and how righteous we are and being judged by law, and I'm better than you are, or you're better than I am, and I got to criticize you, and on and on and on and on and on and on ad nauseum. Now we got to start thinking a completely different way. Our righteousness is a gift from God, apart from works of law. Now, it takes a long time for this to soak in, folks. If this hasn't soaked into you, your righteousness is either earned or it's imputed. Either you're going to get it by law, or it's going to be a gift that you're not going to earn in any part. Not even 1%. None of it. It's going to be a gift. And if you give somebody a gift of $1 million, how are you going to feel if you hear them going around bragging about how they earned a $500,000 of that when you gave them $1 million just as a free gift with no strings attached? You just gave it to them. You just charged it to their account. You dropped it in their bank account. And then when they found out about it, you heard them bragging that they had earned 50% of that. You wouldn't feel too kindly disposed toward them, would you? How do you think God feels whenever we go around like we earn some portion of what he's given us as a gift? Probably not too kindly disposed toward us, would he? In fact, the whole book of Galatians was written to tell you, you don't want to do that. You don't want to go back and start claiming that you earned some part of your salvation. You started out, he said, with a grace gift. What makes you think you can continue? You got righteous as a gift from God. What makes you think you can stay righteous on your own? You can't stay righteous any more than you could get righteous. And see, that really puts us in a tailspin, because we don't know what to do with our lives and righteousness. We don't know how to fit all this in here, doesn't it? If we didn't earn it, if what we're doing doesn't earn us something, then what does it all mean? Well, we're going to talk about that. We actually talked about it in the sermon this morning. Talked about gratitude. God made you a bird, and you have the ability to fly. You don't fly to prove you're a bird. You fly because you can fly. That's what a bird does. God created you unto good works. And that's why you do it. You don't have to prove something. You don't have to earn something. You do good works because that's what God created you to do. Man, this takes some changing up here. It takes some changing up here in our minds. But I'm telling you, if you will talk to God about this, and you'll stay with this, and you keep reading your Bible, and you keep studying this, he's going to change your life. And you're going to like what he does for you. You're going to like the difference that it makes in your life when you get to the point that you do what God wants you to do, because that's what you want to do, and not because you're afraid not to. Not because you're going to lay some claim that because I come to church every Sunday morning and every Sunday night and every Wednesday night and any time in between, and I take the Lord's Supper and I give 10% of my money and I check it at the end of the year to make sure I gave 10% and I did this and I did this and I did this and I did this and I didn't do this and I didn't do this and I didn't do this. That gets kind of tiresome, doesn't it? A lot of people quit. They get discouraged and quit. He gave you a gift of righteousness because he loves you. You got to learn how to accept it. Okay, we'll pick up there, Lord willing, next week. Thank you.